Good afternoon, everyone. Today is March 24th, 2015, and this is a subcommittee on public safety of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. I am going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5516, the Department of Justice budget, and call up Attorney General Rosenblum.
Thank you.
Anyone who would like to join her?
Good afternoon. My name is Ellen Rosenblum, and I'm the Oregon Attorney General, co-chair Representative Williamson, and members of the committee. I also have with me my deputy, Fred Boss, seated to my right, and he'll be speaking after me. Good afternoon, co-chair Shields, as well. On behalf of the entire Department of Justice, we are honored to be here before you this week and appreciate very much the care, time, and attention that you are giving to our agency. When I first appeared before this subcommittee a little more than 2 years ago, I was a newly elected attorney general. Now, in the middle of, or slightly past, the middle of my first term, I am bringing forward a budget request that reflects my priorities developed over this period. First, in my view, the Department of Justice's role is to provide the highest quality legal advice and counsel to state government, our client agencies, boards, commissions, to the governor, and to the legislature if requested. As the legal issues facing our state continue to grow in number and complexity, we take great pride in providing the continuum of legal services from advice calls all the way up through trials, appeals, and settlements as appropriate that help our clients serve the public in compliance with Oregon statutes, rules, and case law. When you're serving as attorney for the government, every single piece of advice we give or cases we handle can affect up to thousands of Oregonians or private entities that engage with state government. So what we do and how we do it is incredibly important to the well-functioning of our state. The other part of our role is to look out for Oregon's most vulnerable citizens, particularly families and children, and our seniors, through our work in consumer protection, child advocacy, child support, crime victim services, and criminal investigations and prosecutions. The need for this advocacy and enforcement has also grown exponentially during these difficult economic times. I am committed to using our limited resources wisely to accomplish these roles effectively. Over the next few days, you will hear from each division administrator at the Department of Justice about the key goals and objectives of our major programs. We also understand that we'll return before the subcommittee with a phase two presentation to describe more in depth the additional investments, our policy packages, that we are requesting. But let me take just a few moments to provide you with some highlights. My budget request includes continuing with the implementation of the Child Support System Project. The initial phase of this project was approved last session. We have been working collaboratively with LFO on updates and completing core planning documents, and will be presenting this project in more depth to the Information Technology Subcommittee next week. A second significant investment request is to retain vital services to victims of crime. Our original request anticipated needing $4.3 million, but as you will hear during the Crime Victim Services presentation, victims' compensation payments from the criminal injuries compensation account have actually slowed, which allows us to reduce the request to $2.34 million. Again, this does not expand services, rather it retains existing services that would otherwise be lost due to insufficient revenue from punitive damage awards. In my time as Attorney General, I have also continued to stress the importance of the services that we provide in the Criminal Justice Division. During the 2014 legislative session, additional resources were provided to temporarily sustain the Fusion Center, and I continue to be concerned that the overall funding level of this division is insufficient to provide necessary assistance to district attorneys and to local law enforcement. In addition to the governor's budget, I am requesting $1.2 million to retain the Fusion Center and $900,000 to support investigations and prosecution in elder abuse cases throughout the state by adding an elder abuse resource prosecutor and two investigators. Sadly, elder abuse is a growing problem as our population ages, both as it relates to financial as well as physical abuse. The Fusion Center will close at the end of this biennium if general fund resources are not approved. I believe that this is an essential tool in protecting Oregonians, not only by conducting threat assessments at significant events across the state, such as governor's inaugurations, the Pendleton Roundup, or the Olympic Trials, just to name a few. But the Fusion Center is also a key resource within the Department of Justice to investigate complex financial crimes and threats to public officials. You will be hearing more about these CJ programs, as we call them, from Chief Counsel Darren Tweed in just a few minutes. And finally, on my part, while no one really likes to talk about administrative costs, unless, of course, they're reducing them, investments in technology and our workforce are essential to providing quality services to Oregonians. My budget includes requests for enhanced litigation support, including e-discovery tools, consolidating facilities, workforce planning, and employee safety. I look forward to working with you over the next few weeks and months to craft a successful budget. I would now like to introduce my deputy, Fred Boss, who will lead off with an overview of our agency and key performance measures. Thank you.
Mr. Boss.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Fred Boss. I am Deputy Attorney General. The Department of Justice is organized into 9 divisions, including the Office of the Attorney General. While many of us can identify ourselves as a law firm, and in fact we are the largest law firm in the state, you'll note that approximately one half of the budget is for child support and for the Crime Victim Services Division. Federal funds, predominantly for the child support program, support one-third of the budget. Roughly another third is supported through the legal fund billable hours, followed by 23% of the budget from general fund and the criminal fine account, and the final 13% supported through other dedicated sources of revenues, such as fees for charitable regulation. The Attorney General's requested budget reflects a 5.6% increase over the 2013-15 legislatively approved budget for all funds, and a 27.7% increase in general funds and the criminal fines account. The agency has 16 key performance measures. As a quick overview, all but 4 of those are in green status, which means that they are within 5% of the approved target. A copy of the full KPM report is found in your Appendix G. The Office of the Attorney General is responsible for not only establishing the state's legal policy, but is active in the consumer outreach and education, managing the AG's legislative agenda, and the internal audit function. Just over a year ago, General Rosenblum appointed me as her deputy. With that appointment came several enterprise-wide initiatives that were either in the formative stages or needed to be started. One of those was the reestablishment of our internal audit function. Due to a retirement, the agency had gone without that function for over a year. We are in the process of finalizing the risk assessment and a review of the process within our central accounting and billing section. For any of you with a history on the Budget Committee, you'll know that there's always been an interest in DOJ's billable rate. Over the last few years, we have been exploring alternate billing methods. We have 16 agencies currently utilizing a flat fee or a retainer method. Many of these agencies are small licensing agencies for which one or two cases involving a conflict with a licensee could have a material effect on their budget. However, we continue to explore other options that would incorporate larger agencies. During this upcoming biennium, we are discussing building alternatives with the Department of Corrections and with the Oregon State Police. Also, we are exploring different options for funding the child advocacy section and exploring full representation of DHS caseworkers in all legal proceedings. You will hear more about the progress of this effort tomorrow or Thursday during the Civil Enforcement Division's presentation. Before calling up the Criminal Justice Division to begin the program overviews, I would like to mention one of the themes you'll be hearing over the next few days. and that is the increasing complexity of the cases that we face and the need for information systems and tools to effectively address this workload. I'd like now to have Darren Tweet, the chief counsel of our criminal division, come up and present on the criminal justice division.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Tweet.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, and members of the committee. My name is Darren Tweet. I'm the Chief Counsel of the Criminal Justice Division. I've been an Oregon prosecutor for now 23 years. This is my third year as the Chief Counsel of the Criminal Justice Division. I'm very honored and privileged to be here in front of you for the second time talking about the Criminal Justice Division's budget and how we work to assist Oregon's district attorneys and law enforcement agencies every day, 365 days a year.
One second.
No, I'll wait.
Okay.
I'm happy to take questions at any time.
It was going to be directed to you.
Thank you.
Mr. Boss.
So we'll just pitch right in then. The Criminal Justice Division currently has 61 positions. Our positions are unlike any other law enforcement agency in the state of Oregon in that we employ both prosecutors, criminal detectives, we call them criminal investigators under the statutes, and they're also named for working purposes special agents. But we have those, and then we also, in addition to that, have criminal analysts that work on our cases with us. If you'll permit me just a little bit of a personal anecdote in explaining this slide, as you can imagine, I walked through this with my family last night one last time. My daughter, my oldest daughter, is home from college on spring break. So I talked to her a little bit about what we do and how many positions we have. And she said, well, Dad, that's amazing. You have all those positions for the entire state. That's a real responsibility for you. And I said, yes, I'm going to be speaking to the members of the legislature tomorrow about what the state funds. And I think it's really important for you to know and write these numbers down. 8, 12, and 14, and 4. There are 8 senior assistant attorneys general that are funded by state funds in my division. There are 12 special agents that, for all intents and purposes, are funded by the state and can conduct criminal investigations throughout the state. And there are 4 analysts in the Fusion Center that are state-funded that we rely on heavily, and you'll see all of the ways that we rely on each of these particular numbers. The rest of those numbers are going to be a few support positions scattered here and there, and then a large number of federal grant programs that I'm not going to talk to you about, but I'm happy to answer questions. Before we do that, though, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that we face in law enforcement and prosecution throughout the state of Oregon, just so that to provide a framework for you regarding the way that we attempt to fill gaps in the state law enforcement community. What we're seeing in Oregon and really throughout the United States is that there has been an exponential proliferation of online child pornography cases in Oregon and throughout the country. We'll talk a little bit about that in the presentation in which I talk about our Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. But what is important for you to know is that really it is the online proliferation of child exploitation cases has gotten so great that no one agency can possibly work them all in Oregon. Secondly, organized crime continues to be a very real and present threat in Oregon. Due to the budget constraints that local law enforcement agencies have had over the past biennium, they are really unprepared in many ways to address local organized crime situations that are multi-county, that are long-term cases, and that may be complex financial crimes. In addition, there is a very real concern about the ability of local law enforcement agencies and the state to information share. We live in a data-driven age, and if you cannot share information even in my field, the law enforcement field, then you're going to be 2 steps behind people that are out to do no good. And then finally, we continue to see and look at trends in law enforcement and prosecution. The Attorney General alluded to this. When we talk about the Policy Option Package 142, you will see that that is the elder abuse resource prosecutor and the 2 criminal investigators. We are seeing a disturbing trend in the Criminal Justice Division relating to elder abuse. It is financial and it is physical. I'll talk a little bit about a prime example in a case that we worked recently. Now, I'm not going to talk about many parts of the division. I'm trying to just focus on the ways that we have filled the gaps that I've identified to you and respond to the challenges that I've addressed. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about our district attorney and law enforcement support program, our Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, our organized crime section, and our criminal intelligence program. And again, I'm not going to focus on any federal funds, just state activities. And regarding the criminal intelligence program, I'm only going to talk about the Fusion Center. As I indicated at the beginning of the presentation, our primary purpose in the Criminal Justice Division is to support Oregon's law enforcement and prosecutors. We do that primarily through our District Attorney and Law Enforcement Assistance Section, although every part of the Criminal Justice Division at times is called on to assist a local district attorney in a prosecution or perhaps local agencies in an investigation. The primary role is taken up by the District Attorney and Law Enforcement Assistance Section. This section has four AAGs, Assistant Attorneys General, and one special agent. Two of those four are actually grant funded. That's the Domestic Violence Resource Prosecutor and the DUI Resource Prosecutor. So we're really talking about two Assistant Attorneys General. But again, I don't want to mislead any of you. Many of our other prosecutors and agents do work in a district attorney or law enforcement assistance capacity. You can see the numbers there. Service assists are those simple phone calls that we take every single day. A prosecutor might be in court on a break for 15 minutes and have a thorny legal issue that pops up. They'll call us and ask for assistance on that. Or an investigator may have a particularly challenging financial case that they just want some basic information about. How do I get a bank record subpoena? How do I go out and get a grand jury subpoena for certain types of information? Many of our law enforcement agencies have cut way back on their detective capabilities. They're simply responding to calls. That's what their budgets allow. We're happy to provide that service. Every year, those service assist numbers go up. In addition, we conducted the number of trainings that you see there, 225 trainings. That's not just this section, that's the division as a whole. We've contributed over 2,100 training hours and have trained more than 10,000 law enforcement officers and prosecutors. We've also acted as the district attorney. The Criminal Justice Division can act as the district attorney when called on by the governor. We do that when the district attorney is no longer able to serve for one reason or another. Often it's a simple retirement, and the governor's office will go through a selection process that I know that you're all very familiar with. That is an incredible tax on the division. We've gone as far as Pendleton. We've been in Klamath County. Fortunately, we were in Lincoln County this time around. And we average about one per biennium of those. In order to do that, we will assign either a prosecutor full-time to go and reside in the county, or if we can't juggle that and break a person off for that specific responsibility, we'll engage a team of prosecutors to manage and oversee the prosecutions of that office.
Mr. Tweet, what's the average length of an assignment?
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee, that depends on the governor's appointment process. We have been left for several months, unfortunately, and we have also had those positions filled relatively quickly, within a few weeks.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bates.
Just a quick comment. I know you guys all live in the Willamette Valley, and you've gone as far as Pendleton, but you know, think of it as a place to go, this nice place to go. You get out of this crummy Medford. Place, all this bad weather. Come down to Medford, have some sunshine. Off time, you have a glass of wine. You know, we're trying to break down this idea that the state ends in Eugene. Okay? So next time you go, take a different attitude. And if it's down in Medford, you're welcome to stay at my house. Won't cost you a penny. Of course, we'll all be in court about that one. But come on, have a glass of wine on my back porch and think of it as a chance to get out of here.
Madam Chair, and just know, Darren, we've been neighbors and friends for a long time.
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, Senator Bates, and Senator Winters, thank you very much for your offer. I'll take you up on that if I can.
You're down or you come on by.
And actually, a little bit later in the presentation, I will talk a little bit about some work that we've done down in Southern Oregon recently.
Representative Barker.
So I know you do all the assisting, and I just saw earlier in the session a request from the district attorney that has Snake River. He's got four capital cases coming, so I assume they'll be leaning on your office to help with that.
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, Representative Barker, members of the committee. That is correct. We've already been in contacted by District Attorney Norris. And unfortunately, any district attorney that has a high proportion of prisons to population right. is going to have that. Many of the murders that we have open or that we have conducted investigations or prosecutions of over the past several years have come out of that county. Marion County has a significant proportion of prisoners, but they have a larger office. So the burden really falls on these smaller offices to conduct those.
Right. Thank you.
And I will add that we conduct all of this at no expense to the individual counties. We provide these services for free through the generosity of the committee and the legislature. I had the opportunity to, regarding those murder statistics, present those murder statistics to the Oregon District Attorneys Association at a meeting a couple of weeks ago, by the way. And that caused the major district attorney counties, the larger population one, to actually literally sit up. And they asked me if those numbers were right. That's 32 murder and aggravated murder cases during this biennium. And we currently have 18 open murder and aggravated murder investigations and prosecutions. That really would fill up a large size detective division and a large to medium size prosecutor's office. And again, we're talking about 8 prosecutors.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Why didn't you charge for your services in those areas? Why you just give it gratis to the counties that, that aren't stepping up and funding their own systems?
Some of them aren't.
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, Senator Bates, and members of the committee. That has been a long-standing tradition for the Department of Justice. Several attorneys general have not charged. I would defer to perhaps to the attorney general, but I would say that as a matter of public policy, strikes me as bad public policy. These are counties that can't do it. They're asking for help. I have the ability, and the attorney general has the ability to assist them, and so why wouldn't we?
Well, if most of these are occurring out of large prison systems, which have been put in those places, even though it's an inconvenient place for the prisoners and their families, it's a major economic value to that county to have those. I still don't understand why they don't take on the burden of this situation, not actually having their own people, but hiring you to come in at a reasonable rate and take care of these cases.
Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Shields, Senator Bates, and members of the committee. Really, that's a broader question for the policymakers, and I'm going to defer.
Madam Chair,
Senator Winters is chomping at the bit.
Yeah, I'm going to stop there, but this is the budget committee.
Yes,
okay.
Right.
Okay.
But I would think that Madam Chair, Senator Bates, that the individuals using the prison system and the investigation is actually a charge of the state. Think about it. You know, usually those crimes occur inside of that state facility.
We were trying to get a big prison down there. We couldn't get it. So, you know,
well, I mean, maybe your climate's too warm.
Oh.
Representative Krieger.
A couple of things. You mentioned flat fee on some counties. Earlier it was talked about. And you represent Department of Fish and Wildlife in 2 lawsuits, one on the Sandy, one on the McKenzie. I'd like to have the figures on the total cost that you build the agency to defend the state on those two lawsuits from the beginning to the end, not just during a particular biennium. And the other thing was on the dependency issue, where some of the counties don't have the Department of DHS doesn't have the capacity to represent themselves, and so you're going to represent them. Now we have a bill, was it 222 or something like that, that would extend the period that they could still represent themselves, which I don't support. They had 2 years to get ready and put something in their budget, and it didn't happen. So I just...
Thank you, co-chairs. Representative Krieger, thank you for your comment about that. The Department of Justice feels strongly that we should be in a position to represent the Department of Human Services at all stages of juvenile proceedings, and appreciate your support of ending the sunset on that bill, on that matter. As far as the issue that was raised by Senator Bates, I would like to respond to that after consulting with my deputy, who's probably got some thoughts on that. We hadn't had the opportunity to discuss it, but I will say that I believe that the district attorneys do the best that they can with the resources they have available, particularly in the smaller counties. I haven't gotten any sense that there's any additional funds available to provide to us, and we try to help as much as we can as a part of this program. There's a long-standing DA law enforcement assist program at the department, and while I haven't gone back to figure out whether we used to charge, it's certainly my hope that we would not have to because of the extreme need and the limited resources throughout those counties that we generally serve.
Thank you. We can move to the next slide. Thank you. So moving forward, one of the areas, and you'll see in the policy action package 142 that the Attorney General referred to, creates the elder abuse resource prosecutor and provides two criminal investigators to conduct these investigations. These cases are on the rise throughout the state, and particularly as the baby boomer generation moves closer or is in retirement. This is simply an example by way of anecdote, but I could repeat this with multiple cases in my division and really throughout the state. What we see in these cases is the betrayal of trust. It's usually a close family member that is taking advantage of the elder. This case occurred in Washington County, so you can see that it occurs in the large counties and the small counties, and they do require a particular skill set in order to navigate all of the ins and outs of the financial records and then dealing with witnesses and victims who are elderly, perhaps, and who may present some special challenges in that way. In this case, Mr. Browning was a municipal court judge in Washington County who stole from his mother and his mother-in-law. And this occurred over an extended period of time. The investigation alone took well over a year, and we relied on the local detective to do that. But again, this was a situation where the local detective, although outraged at the conduct by Mr. Browning, just really wasn't sure where to go. So our lawyers assisted that local detective with obtaining bank records. We provided analysts to look through the bank records, and then we had a prosecutor who had the experience in dealing with victims and witnesses to be able to put this case together. But that's a 2.5-year investigation and prosecution.
Mr. Tweet, are we seeing more prosecutions because of some of the policies that we passed in the legislature as a result of the Elder Abuse Task Force?
Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Shields, Williamson, excuse me, I apologize, and members of the committee, I don't know the answer to that. I will say that there is increased sensitivity amongst law enforcement officials and investigators. Every single one of these is very tragic, and it really sticks in the craw of an investigator. So perhaps that's it, and also just the population is aging.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Chief Counsel Tweed. Did you recommend the sentencing to the judge? Does your lawyer recommend the sentencing to the judge?
Representative Williamson, Senator Shields, and members of the committee, and Representative Wisnett. Yes, we did do that. There was an extreme violation of trust, and also not just to the defendant's mother and mother-in-law, but also to the members of the community.
Follow up.
Mm-hmm.
Last session, we passed, I think it's 826, Senate Bill 826. I may be wrong. It was a bill part of the grand bargain that says that the judge can take part of his PERS retirement. Did you know that, and did you recommend that?
Representative Williamson, Senator Shields, Representative Wisnett, and members of the committee, I don't know if we recommended that or not, and I will follow up.
Thank you, please. I may be wrong on the bill number. It was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I just provided that by way of anecdote, and those stories unfortunately can be repeated. I'd like to move on to our child exploitation section. The Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force is a task force that is a part of that section. This task force is composed of two criminal investigators that are funded by the legislature, two criminal investigators that are funded by federal funds, one analyst that is funded by the legislature, and then every prosecutor in my division. I expect to have the technical expertise and the willpower to conduct these prosecutions because the number of prosecutions is too high for any one prosecutor to manage. That being said, I do have a specifically assigned prosecutor assigned to this unit. You can see the numbers there. We haven't provided a long-term timeline, so the numbers are a little bit abstract, but I can tell you, we'll show you some charts and graphs in the rest of the presentation that will show you the growth over time. So if we could move on to that. A cyber tip is just a tip that is sent to an ICAC task force. There are a number of ICAC task forces throughout the state, throughout the United States. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children receives tens of thousands of cyber tips from internet service providers and citizens and law enforcement officials. They look through these cyber tips, and it could be just something that looks suspicious to somebody. Maybe a parent has seen a chat that a teenager has been conducting on their phone or on a computer. It could be anything. They forward these tips to the National Center. The National Center then tries to establish where is the appropriate investigation to take place. In Oregon, those tips come to us. Every year, you could go back to that slide. Every year since this program began, we have had kind of a linear growth in the program. The bump that you see in 2012 is interesting for a couple of reasons. First, it's because one person was responsible for that. If that one person hadn't been in there, you would see the general linear growth in the number of cyber threats. And that leads me to talk a little bit about how easy it is to collect huge amounts of child pornography. It is one of the easiest things that you can do. And with the availability of increased storage, even on your home personal computer, you can get terabytes of information. You can amass huge, unfortunately, collections of child pornography. We're going to see this trend continue. I had an opportunity to speak with the FBI several months ago. They acknowledge that it's just beyond any one agency, including the federal government agencies, to do that. That's why we're really proud of the work that the ICAC Task Force does. We work with ourselves and with local affiliates, local agencies, to try and get some sort of a handle on these cyber tips. The working of a cyber tip is we'll receive it, we'll kind of triage it. If it looks like it's going to be a case that actually involves a child that we can identify, we drop everything else and we work that case. That case may be, and that means that we ourselves, our criminal investigators, may work it, or we may work it with another allied law enforcement agency. If we can't determine whether or not the child is in danger right then, and if we can't identify the child, then we're going to take a look at the offender. If it's a person with a previous history of sexual offenses or a person in a position of trust, then again, that's a very high priority for us, and we would work that ourselves with using my special agents and calling in other resources if necessary. And then finally, if we can't identify the offender, which happens, we may just have an IP address or some sketchy information, or we can't identify a victim, then we will probably ask another law enforcement agency in the area that we know the suspect may be to work on that case.
Senator Winter, do you keep the statistics by gender?
Representative Williamson, Senator Shields, Senator Winters, and members of the committee, I don't believe that we do, but I can check on that for you. I can tell you, however, that the overwhelming number, just in my experience, of people who collect child pornography are men. The previous slide, by the way, the number of special agents that we have in the ICAC program has remained constant since 2009. So while we've remained pretty much constant, we've seen a 280% increase in the volume of cyber tips. And I can tell you, I go to bed every night and I worry about what we're missing. This is just a graphic. During this time frame, you can see that really almost every area of Oregon, unfortunately, is affected by this. We have cyber tips come in have had them come in during this time period for almost every county. That was, during this time period, by the way, 1,091 cyber tips. Next slide. Peer-to-peer is an information sharing program some of you may be familiar with if you download music or movies or something like that. It's just a software that connects you to the internet and allows you to connect your device, whatever it may be, to somebody else's device, and you can trade files. It's pretty innocuous, and it's actually helpful if you want to grab a movie from somebody or grab some music from somebody. Unfortunately, the criminals are pretty smart, and they've figured out that that's an excellent way to trade child pornography. And so now you have vast collections of child pornography being exchanged from one peer to another peer. That's what this slide shows. And you can see that during this time period, again, there were peer-to-peer cases investigated in almost every county in Oregon. Now, you can write this number down and maybe challenge me on it later on if you like. The number is 13,000. We know, because we have access to the same software sharing programs that everybody else does. We can go online. It's perfectly legal. We don't need a search warrant, and we can just see what's out there. And this heat map that you saw on the previous slide, the gold one, was just, we went out and did that. And for that time period, there were 13,000 internet protocol addresses in Oregon trading child pornography. Yeah, 13,000, 13,000. We don't touch that at all, members of the committee. I mean, honestly, we do our best, but we do not have the resources to conduct 13,000 investigations. And finally, you can see the cases that our agents specifically have worked without the aid of other law enforcement agencies, just on our own. Again, we try to be active as much as possible throughout the state, but we are based in Salem. We have no satellite offices. That you know, interferes to a certain degree with investigations. We are currently conducting at DOJ full criminal investigations on less than 10% of the cyber tips we receive. And that's just a budgetary constraint. The next challenge that I referred to earlier in my presentation related to organized criminal activity. There is organized crime in Oregon. Much of it relates to drug trafficking organizations, as we all know. And this section really attempts to provide local prosecutors and local law enforcement agencies with any help that we can possibly provide in the area of combating organized crime, be it a car theft ring, a fraud ring, or a drug trafficking organization.
Mr. Tweet, and maybe you're going to get to this, but what is the what's the agency doing around Measure 91 implementation? Is there additional resources needed for that, or do you think that that will change your drug trafficking numbers and your this part of your agency, I guess, organized crime cases?
Representative Williamson, Senator Shields, members of the committee, we are really targeting the meth trade and heroin right now, and I don't see that changing. Again, it's just one of those areas where you have to prioritize, and those two substances particularly are of tremendous concern to us.
Thank you.
So the organized crime section assists our colleagues throughout the state by conducting wiretap investigations, undercover and public corruption investigations. One of the areas that we are particularly proud of is our work in multi-county investigations. It's, again, very hard for local district attorneys and local law enforcement agencies to conduct investigations outside of their jurisdiction. They have tremendous budgetary constraints that they're working under. And so I'll give you a couple of examples of how we have put all of this package together in a couple of places. But really, we do this probably half a dozen times a year, or a biennium, excuse me, conduct multi-county, long-term organized crime investigations. That's all that our budget will really allow for. During this biennium, you can see that we worked primarily drug trafficking cases on the organized crime side. Again, that's where we feel that we get the biggest bang for our buck. And we've prosecuted 115 drug trafficking cases and convicted 44 people of racketeering. Racketeering is a tool in our toolbox that we're very happy to have. It's a tool that really allows us to take out the leadership of organizations, not just the foot soldiers.
Senator Bates.
Two questions, Mr. Tweet. One, and they're unrelated. The first one is that we're working very hard to cut down the use of opiates by patients in our area across the state, and we're seeing an uptick in heroin as a result. I'm not sure we're gaining any ground, probably losing ground by doing what we're doing. What's your opinion on that, and what are you seeing as far as heroin growth is concerned? Secondly, what percentage of your drug trafficking? You said you focused on a couple things, heroin and meth. In our county, the focus previously to our last sheriff changeover was on marijuana. Spent a huge amount of money on helicopters and whatnot on marijuana and kind of ignored meth and opiates. What's your sense about what the local people are doing as far as local counties are doing according to what you're seeing, what your sense of that is?
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, Senator Bates, and members of the committee. My first experience on and I used to actually kind of work for a living. I was a line prosecutor at the Department of Justice and a line prosecutor at Marion County DA's office. My first experience with heroin was as a result of a diversion case. What you're talking about is diversion of pills for non-medical reasons. And that case blew up into a huge multi-county heroin investigation. So we do see that. Heroin deaths are they have been on the rise. They may have leveled off in the state. I haven't seen the latest numbers on that. And the rise in the use of heroin can really directly be attributed to one of the factors being diversions of pills. So it's of huge concern. The Attorney General has been concerned about that and asked me to look into, with other members of the department, what can the department do in this issue? We're looking at it, the Attorney General may get back to you. regarding the local, what are the locals doing? The war on drugs is often thrown about, but it really is at the local level just a war. And by that, I mean that a significant amount of resources are being put on the ground for street level dealing. It's very important to communities to get the street level dealers off the streets and just community enforcement. They're doing the best they can. They have budgetary constraints like everybody else. And meth is still a big problem in the state, and heroin is also. So let me provide you a couple of examples. One is on the drug trafficking side, and one is on the more traditional organized crime side. This was a state wiretap investigation. When I say a state wiretap investigation, what I'm talking about is we have the equipment and the legal expertise to conduct wiretaps under a circuit court judge's order, as opposed to my colleagues on the federal side who have to go to a federal judge to obtain a Title III permission. We conduct several of these a year, and they're always with the assistance of the local district attorney, a local judge, and the local police agencies in the area. This happened to be in Medford. We were asked by the, and this happens frequently, we were asked by ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, to assist them on a what they thought was a federal case. Through that, we partnered up with the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Jackson County Sheriff's Office, Klamath Falls PD, Medford PD, and OSP on a multi-county investigation of a street game that came from Oakland, California, of all places. You can see the results there. These results I have repeated similar results in front of this committee before. And this investigation was highly successful. We stopped two homicides. We intervened before the shooters could shoot because we were on phone lines. We solved a bank robbery that could not have been solved otherwise but for the investigations. And we completely dismantled this part of this gang from Oakland, California. So it was a tremendous success. We could repeat this ad infinitum. It's just a question of resources. We know that these groups are out there in every part of the state. The other case that I, just by way of anecdote, just brighten your day maybe, I don't know, give you something else to think about. A traditional organized crime investigation. This we worked with the Portland Police Bureau at their request. So again, we're trying to have a statewide presence, and we really try not to say no to anyone. And this was another wiretap investigation that we conducted with the District Attorney's Office and the Portland Police Bureau. This was a prolific car theft ring, your classic traditional organized crime. I'm going to send my people out to steal your car and inconvenience you. We're going to take it back. We're going to chop it up, and we're going to sell all the parts for scraps and metal. And it's really hard to take apart an organized crime ring, as you can imagine. We've all seen the TV shows. We've read the books. Unless you have an informant, this is the only way to do it. And so we conducted the wiretap investigation. We were able to close this ring down. We seized a couple of businesses and charged 9 people with racketeering and charged more than 20 car thieves. That was a good day's work.
Going back to the gangs, Mr. Tweet, are you involved with Multnomah County? Because they've got a serious, serious gang issue up in Multnomah County.
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, and Senator Winters, members of the committee, yes. First, I recognize that they do have a very serious problem. They are working, with the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the U.S. Attorney's Office. We haven't been asked, and again, we're a support agency, so we go where we're asked to go. So we've talked about organized crime. We've talked about gap filling and responding to challenges in the child pornography area. The final area that we'll talk about is the criminal intelligence area. Again, we all know that if you can't manage data and you can't communicate with other people, you're kind of lost. Successful business people figured this out long before police did. And we're at the stage now where it is crucial for police agencies to talk to each other and to connect the dots, because you can have criminals conducting a crime in one county and then traveling several counties away to commit the same types of crime. A local investigator may not recognize that they're connected. So the intelligence sharing is just a crucial component of what we all do. I'm only going to talk about the Fusion Center. That's, again, because the Fusion Center is state funds. We actually have a very large information sharing group, an analytical group, that receives federal funds under HIDTA, the High Intensity Drug Trafficking Areas. I won't, unless you have questions about them, I just will not talk about them. The Fusion Center supports local law enforcement agencies by conducting these types of things that you see bulleted up there. We have various tools that allow agencies to connect the dots. We have, and more importantly, we have trained analysts that can identify the dots and connect them as well. Again, we have four general funds criminal analysts at this time. We also serve law enforcement throughout Oregon by disseminating BOLOs, Be on the Lookout For, and officer safety bulletins. We prepare threat assessments. The Attorney General mentioned those. Some of the, in addition to the ones that she mentioned, we also, during this biennium, prepared a threat assessments for the Major League Soccer All-Star Game, the Governor's Inauguration. Those are the two big ones that I would add to that list. These are really crucial, we've been told, to the event organizers, just to be able to say, to have someone from outside come in and say, this is what you could be looking at in terms of a threat to your event, is crucial for planning, and is a vital part of what the Fusion Center does. The Fusion Center is also responsible for sharing terrorism-related information after the 9/11 episode, and after reiterated by the Boston bombing episode. What we have all found in law enforcement in regards to terrorism-related activities is that it's crucial for the state and the local and the federal law enforcement agencies to communicate, and to communicate early and often. That's a really important role that the Fusion Center provides by taking in tips and leads and making sure that they get to the right investigative agency, regardless of who it is. We might actually send it to the Oregon State Police or to a local law enforcement agency instead of the Bureau. And then, not to be understated, is the analytical case support that we provide. Again, because of the lack of local resources, many departments don't have analysts that can put together the link analysis that is really necessary to put together complicated cases. Even a homicide case these days may involve two or three different phones and multiple witnesses. And local agencies don't have the resources to devote a detective full-time to that type of work. So we're happy to assist on homicide investigations, gang investigations, drug trafficking investigations. We provide analysts to do the work of putting all of these links and pieces of the puzzle together so the detective can go out and interview the witness or the suspect and be able to make the case ultimately. So the actual measurables for the Fusion Center for this biennium were 25 threat assessments, 2,000 publications, 158 case-related charts and graphs, and 304 intelligence profiles. An intelligence profile is when a detective calls and says, I need a packet of information put together, I'm going to go and interview somebody. And again, it's just key to have as much information as possible on a subject before you go and interview them, especially in an important case. We have a number of databases that other agencies don't have that we can check and provide a real full picture for the investigating officer. And then, to me, this number kind of leapt out at me when I was initially given it to me. You know, I have a lot of different things that I track, and I sometimes forget this is one of the most important. 139 terrorism-related tips and leads that we processed and sent to the Bureau or other agencies. In Oregon, you know, I'm often asked, well, you know, what are the connections in Oregon to terrorism? I'm not a federal agent, but I do know that we sent 139 tips and leads to them.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, the city of Portland decided not to participate or something. Does that hinder your performance of this mission? Has that changed? Are they back in?
Yeah.
Back in.
Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Shields stepped out. Representative Wisnett and members of the committee, I believe you're referring to the Joint Tourism Task Force, and I understand that they are back in. Yeah. So hopefully that answers your question.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
Representative Gorsuch.
Can we go back one slide? The last bullet there, de-conflicting law enforcement operations. Having worked a while back in law enforcement, I know that sometimes agencies don't always get along well. Is that what we're talking about there?
Co-Chair Williamson, Representative Gorsuch, and members of the committee, you know, you caught me because I skipped that. That is actually a HIDTA function, and I really have tried to focus on Fusion Center, but I'm going to answer your question. So one of the missions that HIDTA has is to conduct these deconfliction operations, and the way that we do that is we have computer programs and three analysts that take phone calls. And the idea is that an agent or an officer that's conducting a search warrant in one area will call us in, and we will put an electronic fence around that area. And so if another officer from a different department is going to be conducting an operation in that same area, that electronic fence will ring, and then we will be notified and we'll notify them. Now, that's completely voluntary. And so not every agency adheres to that, but we actually have seen really good success in Oregon. We have a pretty cooperative model at a higher level, and particularly where officer safety is concerned.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wrapping up, and I just want to talk a little bit about our budgetary issues and then our POPs. This is the same slide that I showed last time that I was here with one addition. We've lost 29 positions since 2009. Some of those were federal funds. You know, we went through the Recovery Act grants, but some of them were not. And you can see, and you can probably understand, that we are really stretched very thin to have statewide responsibilities and the numbers of prosecutors and analysts and criminal investigators that we have. It's a constant juggling act. So if District Attorney Norris calls and says, I have another aggravated murder case, what am I to do? I'm going to have to figure out which one of my attorneys that already maybe has one or two, I'm going to assign that to. And then if I get a public corruption case, what do I do there? So what we often do is rob Peter to pay Paul. If something new of a huge priority comes in, why, we're going to take that up and we're going to try and put the other one on the back burner and get back to it as soon as we can. We do have delays, and I suppose they're going to get worse if the current workload continues. And really, we do try to concentrate and account for what the known is. And I'm not going to be Mr. Rumsfeld and talk about knowns and known knowns and unknown knowns, but we really just plan for what we think is going to happen. If you throw in something that is unexpected, it causes chaos in this division. And then the Fusion Center is slated to close. Those four general fund analysts that conduct all of the activities that I talked about, the threat assessments and the assisting other law enforcement agencies and the terrorism-related tips and leads, and then acting as criminal analysts on our own cases, we'll lose them. And that's going to be a tremendous burden on the Criminal Justice Division's own activities, as well as sad for our partners throughout the state.
I'll finish the slide first and ask a question.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
So the closure of that, was it in the governor's budget, or is it the co-chair's budget, and is the new governor on which side is she on this?
Co-Chair Williamson, Representative Wisnett, members of the committee, that was in Governor Kitzhaber's, left out of Governor Kitzhaber's budget, and I do not know the governor's stance.
If I might, co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, I have discussed this with the new governor, and she has not yet taken a position, but I intend to follow up with her.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And the co-chairs, their budget is not that formal at this
right.
point anyway, so I guess.
It's not that detailed.
Yes, ma'am.
It's
Thank
not
you.
In the.
Thank you for your answer, Madam Attorney General.
I don't feel a need to read that slide to you. Again, it's just we have to plan very carefully, and we can't conduct an extreme amount of long-term or complicated cases either on the prosecution side or on the investigative side.
Senator Bates.
There's been a recent change at the federal level on RICO, and how you collect money from these type of things. Has that affected you or affected your budget? It's a federal situation that does affect some locals, but has it really affected you very much?
Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Bates, members of the committee, it has not affected us yet. Although we do participate in some asset sharing with our federal colleagues, it's too early for us to really say how that will affect us.
Okay.
The policy package that I focused on today was 142. That is the domestic or the elder abuse resource prosecutor and the two investigative positions. Those two positions for investigations are key. We continually hear that we need more investigators that are trained in this area and that can really devote the time to putting together a really good case in an elder abuse situation. And then having that prosecutor who can stick to their guns and has the luxury, really, a luxury, of being able to prosecute and investigate a case for over two years is something that really only the Department of Justice can provide. Local district attorneys, again, they are hopping every single day. It's not to say that they won't try or that they can't do it, but we are in a really good position at the department to step into this really important role. The rest of those, I don't have much to say other than the Fusion Center is slated to close if we lose those state funds. This leads us finally to the 10% reduction scenario. At the end of the 10% reduction scenario, as you can imagine, the division would be devastated. We just have personnel costs for the most part. We have some equipment costs through our investigators, but our prosecutors rely on kind of the number two pencil and a laptop to get their job done. So we would cut positions. By the end of a 10% reduction, we would have to lower our caseload by about 80 cases. Again, I don't know. I would sit down with the Attorney General and seek some guidance from her about which of those cases we should cut. Should it be child pornography? Should it be murder? Should it be elder abuse? Should it be a complicated drug trafficking organization? And then in addition, there are some types of categories of cases that we probably would not be able to, that we would choose to not investigate or prosecute any longer just because of resource restrictions. Tax cases might fall into those areas. Certain types of election law violations might fall into those areas, and so on. I think that concludes the presentation. Thank you very much for your time.
Questions?
I just want to briefly. So I've seen a couple bills that want to have investigations of police shootings go to your office, and from what I'm hearing today, that would be a problem.
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, Representative Barker, we could not do that under our current staffing, just to be blunt.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, Senator Winsett. Representative Wisnett, sorry. I didn't mean to do that to you.
Promotion.
I'm used to it. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this would be the Attorney General, because it was back on slide 12, or Mr. Boss wants to come forward. You had billing. I know from my past experience on this committee that the agencies get billed certain thing. Could you talk about the pilot project public safety agencies you're doing, or what's that all about? Because
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senator Wisnett. It
representative.
I do take that as assault. Not the name, but the senator.
I do apologize. We are piloting a flat fee in several of our agencies, so agency clients. What has we've experimented with smaller agencies on a flat fee in order to just level out their legal fees so they don't have these wild ups and downs so if they have any problems. This next biennium, what we planned on doing is taking that pilot that we've been using with these very small boards and commissions and agencies like the PUC and taking it to larger agencies. So we have sat down with our clients at Department of Corrections, which is a relatively large agency, and the Oregon State Police, and gone over the model to use a flat fee model for them in order to level out their cost and to see whether or not that we can, both agencies can have a savings because of the just kind of paying in hunks a level flat fee. We have experimented, in fact, for the last 2 or 3 years with Oregon Youth Authority, and the client has been very pleased with that. The client believes that the costs have been maintained and if not lowered. Our folks, the folks especially at the Department of Corrections, we've been in a series of conversations with them, and they're fairly enthusiastic about it. We hope to roll it out probably towards the fall time and run it as an experiment to see if this is a model that we might be able to use for the entire Department of Justice.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just and it's not that particular question, but the question of actually working with, and I'm thinking of the bigger agencies, and also with DAS, in looking at ways to kind of lower, if you will, what I see that's trending, particularly in some of the agencies, the lawsuits that actually end up costing us quite a bit, because we, you know, we're self-insured, and this is the risk management piece, and whether or not there's been some thought maybe given to, and I can recall I had this conversation several years ago, and maybe the Attorney General's office would help to probably train some of the agencies to look at what to do or not to do, particularly in the supervisory management level. Is that still a thought or a thinking that maybe this is the role that Attorney General's office can play with the agencies that you represent?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senator Winders, yes. And that is something that our trial division certainly has a hand in training agencies. Another thing that we're doing is that we had since up till 2007 what we call the public law conference, in which every other year we trained all agency personnel, not just the heads but down to the middle management ranks, on essentially how to be a state manager, and among them were how to avoid lawsuits, especially in the employment area and other areas. We have reinstituted that public law conference. We will have it this fall. We will have it next fall, and then once we have it next fall, it will roll on a every other year basis. But we certainly view that as our obligation to train the state agencies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-chairs Williamson and Shields and members of the committee, would you like us to proceed with the presentation of the Civil Enforcement Division?
Mm-hmm. We've got about 20 more minutes.
All right. Then I'll present Lisa Udlin, the chief of our division.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Udlin. I'm the chief counsel of our Civil Enforcement Division. The Civil Enforcement Division employs over 200 people, half of whom are attorneys. The remainder are legal staff and investigators. We have offices in 5 cities: Portland, Salem, Eugene, Pendleton, and Medford. The Civil Enforcement Division carries out a wide range of responsibilities, generally geared toward enforcing state civil law, as well as protecting Oregon consumers, families, and children. As you can see from our organizational chart, the work of the Civil Enforcement Division is divided into 5 units or sections, and I will briefly walk you through each of those units. First, we have the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection section. The purpose of this unit is to protect Oregon consumers from fraud in their purchases of real estate, goods, and services. This is done through enforcement of the Unfair Trade Practices Act, the antitrust laws of Oregon, and the Oregon False Claims Act, as well as by providing consumer education and acting as a resource to various consumer groups. There are a number of elements in our goal of protecting and assisting Oregon consumers. Because it is our belief that well-educated consumers are less likely to be victims of fraud, we work hard to provide consumer education. We have an outreach coordinator who presents information to consumer groups throughout the state and coordinates the department's involvement in annual events such as the Scam Jam. We print and pass out educational materials on a number of topics in English, Spanish, and Russian. We issue a yearly list of top 10 consumer complaints, and we issue consumer alerts to quickly inform consumers of the latest scams. Our unit fields approximately 60,000 complaints each year. We have a hotline staffed with 29 volunteers that works each day, and they receive approximately 50,000 complaints a year. We also receive approximately 8 to 10 complaints in writing or online. Once a complaint is received, it is reviewed by our enforcement officers. The enforcement officers communicate with complainant and the business to see if the issue can be quickly resolved. Many of the complaints are resolved at this level. However, if that doesn't work, we refer the complaint to an attorney and investigator for further work. In many cases, we then need to initiate litigation. For instance, the section recently investigated a telemarketer that used high-pressure tactics to convince consumers that they could be their own boss by purchasing services to start an at-home business. Once the telemarketer had the consumer on the hook, the telemarketing company would call back posing as a different business, offering to sell the consumer services and products such as business coaching, credit services, and corporate document drafting, all with the idea that these would help the business succeed. In this circular sales cycle, Oregon consumers were strung along, all while going into deeper debt under the promise that they would build their own home business. After the section issued investigative demands, the telemarketer agreed to cease business in Oregon, refund $80,000 to the Oregon consumers, and pay a $50,000 penalty to the state of Oregon. In addition, a few months ago, the section helped lead a multi-state investigation against national telecom carriers for wireless cramming. In this scheme, third parties were using the phone carrier's billing systems to charge consumers for services the consumer never ordered, like horoscopes, trivia, and sports scores, all at the rate of about $9.99 a month. The investigation led to settlements nationwide. The Oregon-specific settlements required the phone companies to pay restitution to Oregon consumers to correct their conduct going forward, and to deposit approximately $1.5 million into our protection and education account. Some of the section's largest cases involved pharmaceuticals and medical devices. For example, we obtained a $4 million settlement with DePue Orthopedics relating to allegations that DePue knowingly marketed a line of metal-on-metal artificial hips that were prone to disintegrate, leaving metal debris behind and sometimes damaging muscles and requiring follow-up surgery. The work of the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection section is fully self-funded through civil penalties and settlements paid to the Protection and Education account. Over the past few years, we have seen a number of changes in the unit's workload. For example, we are seeing an increase in the complexity of cases, particularly as the number of consumer transactions on the internet grows, which allows easier access to Oregonian consumers from fraudsters located out of state. Further, the volume of documents in our cases is growing exponentially due to the business's use of electronic documents and email, as well as a general litigation trend toward moving in toward e-discovery. This has a significant impact on the cost of our cases. Last, we've seen the addition of new work to the Unfair Trade Practices Act, such as athlete agents, patent trolls, and the Oregon False Claims Act.
Question?
Mm-hmm. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mrs. Unlin, I had a lot of skin in the foreclosure issue, the banking settlement. Could I get a report on how that money was completed and what the status of that is? We still have in the legislative body about $20 million left that was dedicated to counseling and mediation. And I know that you took some of that money, too, for expenses, and I'd like to have a report on where we are on that.
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee, Representative Wisnant, will be happy to get you one.
Thank you.
A report. Next, we have our Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. The Medicaid Fraud Control Unit operates a federally mandated program to address fraudulent practices in Oregon's Medicaid program and in the Oregon Health Plan. The Medicaid Fraud Unit focuses on physical and financial abuse and neglect by Medicaid and OHA and Oregon Health Plan providers and harm that occurs to residents of long-term care facilities. They provide specialized assistance to district attorneys, as well as training and education to help to the public to help reduce fraud. For example, this unit worked with the Coos County DA to convict the executive director of a senior living facility who had funneled more than $50,000 of a resident's money to his own bank account. As a result, the court ordered repayment of that money to the victims and their families. Staff in the unit helped obtain a conviction of a Nevada couple who are falsely claiming need-based benefits from a number of Oregon agencies. Both the husband and wife were sentenced to prison time and ordered to pay restitution of over $200,000 to the DHS and the Housing Authority of Washington County. Finally, through work with the National Association of Medicaid Fraud Control Units, this unit prosecuted caretakers who divert medications from their elderly persons for their own use and closed two adult foster homes due to abuse and neglect of the residents. The Medicaid Fraud Unit is funded through a combination of federal funds at the 75% level. The remaining 25% is fully self-funded through penalties and settlements similar to the Financial Fraud Unit. This unit consistently achieves positive results with a small number of staff compared to other states. For example, in 2014, they concluded 42 cases and brought in $15 million in recovery. As with the Financial Fraud Unit, the Medicaid Fraud Unit is seeing an increase in the sophistication of fraud, particularly given the electronic age, as well as more referrals of neglect and abuse cases, financial abuse cases. And again, the cost toward the trend toward electronic discovery is an issue for this unit as well. Next is our charitable activities section. The primary mission of the charitable activities section is to regulate charities and gaming activities in Oregon, as well as to protect charitable assets. This is done through curtailing misleading charitable solicitations, fostering a climate where donors can make informed decisions and donate money with confidence, and identifying and correcting breaches of fiduciary duty by officers and directors of charities, and by working to protect charitable assets. This unit licenses and regulates charitable activities. In fact, they currently have more than 19,000 registered charities, as well as a number of professional fundraising firms and nonprofit gaming activities. The unit works cooperatively with charitable organizations to resolve compliance issues. For example, staff recently worked with a board member of a local scholarship fund to ensure that the charitable assets were properly accounted for so the fund could continue to give scholarships.
Senator Shields.
Thank you very much. Ms. Edlin, the Department of Justice then has the authority in statute to investigate nonprofit organizations and to see if they're truly living up to their nonprofit mission. Is that right?
Co-Chair Williamson and Co-Chair Shields, yes, that is true.
And follow up, if I can. Are there any other state agencies that can do that, Department of Revenue, or is it purely under the purview of the Department of Justice?
Co-Chair Williamson and Co-Chair Shields, my understanding is that we are the only ones that have the authority to investigate the charitable purpose. There may be tax issues, and we certainly wouldn't have that authority.
Okay, and then one last one, if I could. Does that happen often? Do you know how many you might have decertified in the last year or so, or could you get that to the professional staff?
Co-Chair Williamson and Co-Chair Shields will get you that number.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to follow up on that. I think it's a great service you do. I look at when you put out your list of charitables and how much they give and everything. I have a couple of questions. Do you have legislation before this session that is helping you with anything in that role?
Co-Chair Williamson and Co-Chair Shields, Representative Wisnant, members of the committee, we recently passed legislation in the last session. This session we're asking for a fee increase. We have not had a fee increase in this unit since 1985.
I was looking at like any more rules, and because they're going to have to handle the money, the bosses over here. But is there like do we need to like have a maximum on administration? I know you report that, but has other states had a maximum administration and things like that? It would help. We can get back. You don't have.
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, Representative Wisnant, members of the committee. We are doing rulemaking under the authority we recently received.
Good.
And that is in progress.
Thank you. Just one last comment. The senator left. Are you looking at 501c3s and 4s when you look at nonprofit?
Co-chair Co-chair Williamson. I see the co-chair Shields left, Representative Woods, members of the committee. I know we're looking at 501c3, and I'd have to get back to you on the 4s.
Because that's where we had all the national attention, as I guess you know, is what. Because when Senator Shields was asking about how many you do and everything like that, we don't want to have a problem like we had at the national level. So I appreciate the feedback on that to the committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members of the committee, this unit, the charitable unit, also takes enforcement action when, finally, for this unit, education is a key component. The staff frequently works with members of the nonprofit community to educate nonprofit directors on their responsibilities. As with our other units, the charitable activities unit is completely self-funded. It receives no general fund dollars. The funding of this unit is through licensing fees. It's based a sliding scale based on organizational revenue. For example, for a charity with a revenue of less than $5,000 a year, the fee is $10 a year. If you're a charity with revenue of more than $1 million a year, you pay $200 a year. As I mentioned, the unit is requesting its first fee increase since 1985. This is in large part due to the growing number of charities in Oregon. In fact, the number of charities has grown by 6,000 in the past 10 years. That means we're seeing an average of 600 to 700 new charities each year. We're also seeing an increase in complexity of charitable activities and oftentimes an abuse of the corporate form or corporate structure as a way to get a funnel funds through to avoid other laws. Next is our civil recovery section. Lawyers in the civil recovery section are the plaintiff lawyers for the state. This means they're out enforcing laws and bringing actions on behalf of state agencies. These lawyers and staff litigate all claims for money and property owed to the state and assist agencies in seeking legal relief. For example, these attorneys represent the Department of Forestry in recovering costs incurred in fighting intentional forest fires and assist agencies in collecting the overpayment of benefits. This unit also represents agencies in bankruptcy matters. For example, they assisted the state treasury in recovering funds from the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy. Their goal is maximum recovery at minimum cost. As you can see from our chart, the civil recovery section brings in generally about $20 million each biennium. You can also see that this amount can fluctuate greatly because punitive damages are included. For example, in the 2011 and 2013 biennium, we received a large punitive damage amount on the Williams tobacco case. But generally, recoveries are in the $20 million range. Attorneys in the civil recovery section also assist Oregon children and families by representing the Division of Child Support. They establish, modify, and enforce child support orders, establish paternity, and pursue contempt actions against parents who don't pay. And we've found that these contempt actions greatly increase collection of the payment of child support to Oregon children. We also have a very small unit of attorneys who enforce Oregon's environmental and cultural resources laws. Their job is to protect the public health and natural resources, to create a level playing field for compliant businesses, and to act as a resource for state agencies and district attorney's offices. Another very important component of the Civil Enforcement Division and the Civil Recovery Section is protection of the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement funds. Pursuant to the terms of the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement, companies who participate in the MSA pay Oregon approximately $160 million each biennium. These funds are deposited directly to the Oregon Treasury. Under the MSA, the participating companies will make similar payments into perpetuity. Since approximately 2006, the states participating in the Master Settlement Agreement have been involved in a payment dispute with the participating manufacturers. As a result of that dispute, the participating manufacturers have been withholding approximately $10 million from Oregon's payment each year since 2006. Due to the structure of the MSA, the payment dispute, which I will discuss in a subsequent slide, puts Oregon's entire payment at risk each year. By entering into the Master Settlement Agreement, Oregon agreed to enact and diligently enforce certain statutes located at ORS 323-800-806. To comply with these obligations, the Civil Recovery Section staff employs staff who are charged with regulating MPMs, that is, those companies who do not participate in the MSA. They must put money in escrow each year and fulfill a number of reporting requirements. In addition, staff in this unit regulates all cigarette sales in Oregon, both those for companies who participate in the MSA and those who do not participate in the MSA, through a certification process, which is a lot like registration, and by auditing where necessary. In 2013, Oregon participated in the first nationwide arbitration regarding whether participating states in the MSA had diligently enforced their escrow statutes during calendar year 2003. The arbitration was conducted before a panel of three retired federal judges who concluded that Oregon had, in fact, met the diligent enforcement requirement, and as a result, Oregon received its full payment in April of 2014. The panel also determined that several states had not diligently enforced, and those states lost their entire 2003 payment, millions of dollars. Oregon is currently engaged in working toward a similar arbitration to resolve the diligent enforcement question for calendar year 2004. It is very important that we stay fully engaged in this process, as Oregon's entire payment for 2004 is at risk.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Bates, you have a question on your face, if nothing else.
The last time I checked is 2015.
Yes.
Just saying.
I think that might be the issue.
So we're getting paid from 2004.
If all goes well.
If 11 years.
It's, so you just keep rolling it through each year. And
Coacher Williamson, members of the committee, yes. I will conclude today, given the time, but if you have other questions.
Questions? All right. I'm going to close this, the public hearing on Senate Bill 5516. Anything from the committee? We'll be back here tomorrow.
Back here tomorrow.
Continuing where we left off. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We are adjourned.
Much.
We are adjourned.